Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to my Critical Family History podcast. My name is Emma Marie Bishan Harrison. Just a little bit of background about me. I was born on December 20th, 1987, in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. When I was 4 years old, my family and I, we moved to Brampton, Ontario, which was a suburb of Toronto. Now it's almost close to a million people that live there. But that is primarily where I grew up, and I went to university in Toronto. A little bit more about me. I identify as a biracial female. My mom is from Scotland, specifically the east end of Glasgow, Easter House. And my dad is from Guyana. So he grew up in different towns. One was called Reed and Hoop, and another one was Canal. So how I've decided to organize this podcast was inspired by the social study themes and our cultural research assignment. And so I drew from these categories, and that's kind of how I organized the information and the interviews that I had. I interviewed my mom and my dad, and I've taken what they've talked about to help inform this podcast. So, I've started out talking a little bit about myself, and then I hope to look at the theme of time, continuity, and change, as well as people, places, and environment. And then I'll look at the theme of culture, which is pretty broad, but we'll get into more specifics about that. Then I'll move on to the theme of individuals, groups, and institutions. Specifically looking at the influence of religion in both of my mom and my dad's lives. And last, I'll finish with how theme number four, so individual development and identity, ties in as I have some closing thoughts at the end of this podcast. So, So just before we get into the themes that I talked about, I just wanted to have a little quote here from Leanne Simpson, and she had a piece from 2014 called Land as Pedagogy, and I wanted to take two different quotes here from page 10 and page 11, and Simpson here talks about deriving meaning through relationships, which when I think about this podcast and the research and preparation that's gone into this, I feel like these quotes ring true. So she talks about having a long-term, stable, balanced, warm relationships within families, extended families, the community, and all living aspects of creation. Intelligence flows through relationships between living entities, end quote. And then on page 11, Simpson also states, quote, meaning then is derived not through content or data or even theory in a Western context, which by nature is decontextualized knowledge, but through a compassionate web of interdependent relationships that are different and valuable because of that difference. Individuals carry the responsibility for generating meaning within their own lives. They carry the responsibility for engaging their minds, bodies, and spirits in a practice of generating meaning, end quote. So I wanted to start off with those quotes from Leanne Simpson. And in that piece, it is talking about the land as pedagogy, the land as teacher. But those specific quotes also talk about this knowledge that can come down through relationships. And so, as I mentioned, the research that went in to this assignment and interviews with my mom and dad, I feel like I was able to get a deeper sense of meaning with regards to my past, my identity. I uncovered information that I found to be interesting that I hadn't known up until this point. So that quote really rings true for me and influences my outlook on this assignment. So now we'll turn some time over to explore themes of time, continuity, and change, as well as people, places, and the environment. Welcome back to the next segment of this podcast. I'm going to be taking a more in-depth look at both the family histories of my mom and my dad, and talking a little bit more about where they grew up. Before I get into that, I just wanted to draw from the Washington State K-12 Social Studies Learning Standards from January 2013, version 1.2. And I took the approach of zoning in and focusing in on overall hopes for first grade. And it says here, the context, or in first grade, students develop their understanding of basic concepts and ideas from civics, economics, geography, and history. The context for social studies learning in first grade is the family and the ways they choose to live and work together. Students are asked to think about families nearby and those far away, end quote. And that came from page 14 of that resource. And so I thought that was very interesting because as you go through the different grades, it gets very specific with regards to US history. And because I'm Canadian and my family immigrated to Canada, we don't have that linkage to US history specifically. But I liked how in first grade, it started off with the microcosm of families. And also here, I focus specifically on the first grade geography standard, component 3.2.3, which understands why families make the decision to move. It could be jobs, it could be family sizes, just trying to overall get that understanding of human interaction with the environment. And then I also link the material in this podcast to the first grade history standard, component 4.1, which understands historical chronology or family timelines. And so I feel like this is very relevant to what I'm doing right here and what I have been doing to go back and trace different lineages and the histories associated with that heritage. So I just wanted to mention that because it helps to inform this whole podcast. As I mentioned, the assignment, the cultural me search assignment, has helped to influence this podcast as well. And for the specific theme of time, continuity, and change, I had chosen a picture of my paternal great grandfather, Samwaru, who was a very important figure on my dad's side of the family. And so I just wanted to mention a little bit about that. And it's important to know, when I was talking with my dad, he mentions over and over again how census records and family lineage records are very spotty in Guyana. And it's more of like an oral tradition of passing the info down from generation to generation. But the paradox or the contradiction there is that he mentioned it was also taboo to ask questions about, you know, previous generations or family members. Sometimes there were different scandals, if you will, or not so savory bits of information that I think my dad was mentioning adults did not feel the need to talk about with their kids. So now my dad has tried to like ask his parents, who are in their late 80s, some of the information he always wondered about. And I'm kind of siphoning off of that by asking him what they have, what they've mentioned to him. But so going on my dad's side and trying to trek that journey and the influence of Samaru, I wanted to talk about my paternal great-great-grandparents, Rahade and Basawan, who came over from India to Guyana as indentured servants under the British system. So under this system, people were brought to Guyana to work on the sugar plantations for several years of service. And there was the promise that afterwards they could either go back home to India or have a change of status that would allow them to own some land in Guyana. Rahade and Basawan, they had a son named Samaru, and that's who I mentioned in the picture. And Samaru went on to have two sons named Ramdial and Bishan. Bishan is my grandpa, and he is still alive today. So something interesting, when Ramdial and Bishan signed up for school in Guyana under the British system, again, there's that colonizing imperialism that was present there. When these brothers registered for school, the British school system required a first name and a surname. And so, you know, like at that point, they had only been going by one name. So they actually broke Ramdial into Ramdial and selected Dial to be the surname. And so they tacked on that new surname to my grandpa's first and only name, Bishan, to conform to these British standards. So that's something I wanted to talk about, this naming origin. And you can see there the British influence of Guyana at the time perforated the schooling system, and even something like names and the significance there. So yeah, as mentioned, my dad's side of the family, his ancestors came from India to Guyana. And when I talked to him about his upbringing, he mentioned this notion of the sacrifice of our ancestors and how this sacrifice was generational. And the focus for my dad was for him and his siblings to become educated and to get off of the farms and the plantations and break that cycle. But it took the sacrifices of people like Samaru, people like Rahade and Basawan, who had to work incredibly hard to allow for the generations in the future for them to achieve those dreams. So that's a little bit about my dad. We'll get back to him a little bit later. Now I turn over to my mom. And as mentioned, she grew up in Scotland, specifically Easter House, which was the east end of Glasgow, which was considered to be very poor. And just in my interview with my mom, she mentioned how back when she was growing up, and even to some degree to today, the prevalence of teen pregnancies, and how there was not really an incentive to work once you got out of high school at age 16, because the government would take care of you. So there was a lot of unemployment that was prevalent there. Similar to what my dad had mentioned, my mom also mentioned that like family issues weren't ever discussed, or especially weren't discussed with or in front of kids. And with that, there's a lot of taboos and secrets. And talking to my mom, I uncovered some things that I hadn't known before, but I feel like by doing this assignment, also being respectful of my mom and dad and what their wishes were. They are comfortable with me sharing this information, and they were comfortable enough to share it with me. But I think it's interesting how this assignment is very liberating and frees up these taboos, and by exposing them, it helps as a learning tool, and you know, to get rid of that shame and just to destigmatize. So I think this is also a very empowering assignment. I felt that it's been this way, and I think when talking with my mom and my dad, it's almost been like a liberating experience for them to talk about some things as well. Also going back to my mom, her mom, my granny or grandma, I call her granny, was a single parent, had three kids, worked part-time, and each child that my granny had a different father who is not in the picture for the most part. My mom talks about back in Glasgow, there being a lot of gangs, a lot of violence, extreme poverty, struggles with alcoholism, both in Glasgow and also in terms of generational and hereditary histories there. My mom talks about, she remembers my granny having some anger issues and actually mentioned that she struggled with depression. Her mental health was not at its best, and at some point she was taking medication for her depression. But there was a lot of repression of what was going on. Again, not a lot of talk about family. Didn't want to bring up the hard past, and some kind of taboo topics. Also, just to situate my mom in a certain time and place. My mom also mentions that she remembers, for the most part, Glasgow being predominantly white. And she mentioned that people of color, the only time that she would see people of color would be those that were studying at the university. I asked my mom about overall Glaswegians or people from Glasgow, their tolerancy level. And my mom said that Glaswegians were not tolerant of minorities at all. That included the Irish and people of South Asian descent who would be running a lot of the convenience stores. So outside of the university, convenience stores would be another place where the only people of color would be present in my mom's neighborhood. And my mom recalls people, friends, family, looking down on these minorities and just thinking of them as less than. So that's in terms of racial hierarchies, that kind of lends itself to the environment at the time there. In terms of class distinctions, I mentioned that, you know, the East End of Glasgow was considered to be very poor. But there was also distinctions in the accents. So my mom talks about the Glaswegian accent as being like very nitty gritty and looked down upon by people from different upper class or middle class neighborhoods. And so is this double-edged sword that she mentioned, where you're criticized by Glaswegians if you spoke polite, she called it, like you're trying to better yourself or you're being a snob. But then if you spoke Glaswegian, other people in more affluent areas would look down on your your dialect. So that double-edged sword of even relating to accents in the English language and dialects in the English language was something that my mom focused on a lot when I had interviewed her. So that's just a little bit of background information to kind of situate my mom and dad and where they were growing up when they were in the 60s and 70s in, for my dad, Guyana, and for my mom, Glasgow, Scotland, respectively. Guyana, very hot climate. Scotland, very much overcast, kind of damp, similar to Seattle weather, rainy. And so, yeah, that's just to situate where my mom and dad were coming from a little bit more about that. And so in the next segment, I'll look at this idea of culture, this theme of culture, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Next, I want to talk about the social studies theme of culture, referencing back to my cultural research assignment. For culture, I represented that with a Canadian flag. And when I think of the Canadian flag, it makes me feel incredibly proud, and it's very linked to my identity. For me, the Canadian flag and Canada in general represents tolerance, an invitation to celebrating many cultures gathered in one country. There's a sense of belonging that I feel when I see that flag. And the maple leaf invokes picturesque images of Canada's vast, diverse, and beautiful landscapes. And so when I was linking it to this podcast and to some of the readings that we've done in our social studies class, I thought of Robin Kimmerer's Maple Nation, A Citizenship Guide. And that comes from her book called Braiding Sweetgrass from 2014. And so I have two quotes here from Kimmerer. The first one kind of links to how I'm feeling. I know we'll get to my parents back in a second, but I've recently immigrated to the US from Canada. I recently got married to my husband, who is American. And so I've traveled. When I think about why people move, going back to that social studies standard of why do families move? Why do people move? For me, moving from Canada, a place that I love and hold so dearly to my heart, to the States, it was motivated by love. And as we will see when we talk about my dad and my mom, their motivations to leave their home countries and come to Canada are different. But anyways, going back to this quote from Robin Kimmerer from Maple Nation, A Citizenship Guide, that's the specific chapter. She states, quote, "The United States rarely permits dual citizenship. You have to choose. On what basis do we select where to invest our allegiance? If good citizens agree to uphold the laws of the nation, then I choose natural law, the law of reciprocity, of regeneration, of mutual flourishing," end quote. So yeah, that's something that I've thought about. I actually hold Canadian and British citizenship right now. And I'm in the process of applying for residency here in the United States. But when I think about American citizenship, this idea of pledging allegiance and having to choose between one or the other, that to me is a very difficult choice, because as I mentioned, Canada holds such a special place in my heart and is like interwoven with my identity. So that's just, I don't know, that quote resonated with me. Another quote from Robin Kimmerer on the same page, page 173, she states, quote, "It's a running threat on the left and the right. If things don't change, I'm moving to Canada. It looks like the Maples will have to do just that. Like the displaced farmers of Bangladesh fleeing rising sea levels, Maples will become climate refugees," end quote. So I know that in recent times, we've heard people want to move up to Canada in the recent political atmosphere, with the election of the current president. I know that there has been a lot of talk about this move to Canada, but I bring that up because I want to tie it into, as I mentioned, my dad and my mom's motivations for wanting to move to Canada back in the 80s. So I'll talk about my dad first. Ultimately, it was education that was the motivating reason for him to move from Guyana to Canada. This idea of education as being liberating and exposing you to opportunities, again, getting off the farm or the plantation. My dad, when I had interviewed him, he kept referencing the show Survivor and juxtaposed that with this idea of education as a means for a select few, about a quarter of the people that went to school, to get off the island. Not in a way of like, you know, your time in the game coming to an end, but as a way to get outside of this cycle, to the limiting opportunities and to go somewhere else where more opportunity was supposed to be had, and education as the key to achieve that. My dad also mentioned, this is something interesting and new that I hadn't known about my dad before, but he talks about his fourth grade teacher, Miss Ramsaran, and talks specifically about not liking her or being in her class because she was very strict. But in the end, he realized that she was just trying to tap into his potential. But she was actually a person, one of the first people that my dad knew that married somebody who was also in Guyana, but they married and then they left to go up to Canada and immigrated to Canada. My dad also talks about his friend, John Chan, in Guyana as well, and how his family moved up to Manitoba in the late, mid to late 70s. So I had never known that my dad had seen people before him from Guyana make the trek up to Canada. So yeah, as mentioned, my grandpa or my dad's dad, who was a surveyor in Guyana, my dad describes him as sinking all of his finances into the education for his kids. And my dad talks about his schooling experience, and that was heavily influenced by the British system. And so there were different tests that he could take. And I think he took A-levels. And actually, he did really well. And he taught for a little bit in Guyana. And then he later applied to go to the University of Calgary to study electrical engineering and got into that program. And he talks about some of his siblings already making the trek up to Canada just before he got into university up there. Some were in Calgary and other siblings were in Montreal. My dad also talks about the culture shock that he experienced when going from a hot climate with hardly any white people in Guyana and moving up to Calgary, Alberta in the 1980s, which was predominantly white. He talked about having to get used to a lot of changes in the food that they were eating in the cafeteria. He was looking for roti and curry, and instead they were serving like schnitzel and mashed potatoes and eating with silverware. And this was something that my dad said was foreign to him. And he was looking for the food that he grew up with and loved. My dad also talks about in terms of this culture shock, because we are talking about this theme of culture, the difference in climate. It gets really cold up in Calgary. And my dad recalls like bundling up with like scarves and gloves and a really thick jacket for just barely above the freezing mark. Meanwhile, other people on the bus were wearing like a spring jacket because they were used to the cold, and it can get colder. So that seemed warm to them. And they're kind of laughing at my dad because he was overdressed. But coming from a hot climate like Guyana, Calgary was a major, major difference. Also a difference in activities. My dad was used to playing dominoes and cricket, and compared to what was going on in Calgary, there's a lot of emphasis on video games. You got to think about this is the 80s, so those were very prevalent. So yeah, just culture shock. What was surprising, though, is I asked my dad, if he can recall any sort of discrimination or overt racism or microaggressions or any of those things. And my dad said he didn't experience racism when he moved to Canada. And I thought that that was a very interesting statement, especially with this past quarter studying in the LTEP program, where we are challenged to critically think and analyze. And I thought to myself, okay, I don't know how much of that is accurate, as my dad being one of the very few people of color in predominantly white Calgary, how that could be the case. But then my dad went on to later say that he just kind of expected people to think lower of him. So if there was any sort of racism, he didn't notice. And he also thought that the educated people at university were not racist. And he talked about different friends or different people who were white that had befriended him and had a genuine concern for him. But I thought earlier in my childhood, I had heard of stories of, you know, microaggressions towards my dad back in Calgary. But he didn't bring any of those up in the interview. And as I said, didn't really notice any racism towards him. So I think that's interesting. I think that also influences how my parents talk to us, or I should say maybe didn't talk to us specifically and explicitly about race. No one ever had a conversation with me saying, hey, you're biracial. Like, let's talk a little bit about that. There was always like a subtle nurturing of pride for all aspects of my heritage and the food and the music and the culture there. But there wasn't any explicit confrontations or conversations about race and racial identity. So I thought that that was a very telling part of the interview where my dad mentioned he didn't feel like he experienced any racism. Segueing into my mom's experience and her motivations. Again, we're talking about this idea of motivations for coming to Canada. My mom had a friend who was Mormon, who I'll talk later a little bit more about, who went to Canada as a nanny. And so my mom's rough upbringing, just extreme poverty, And, you know, just this kind of cycle that she could see of not really having like a plan and getting stuck in this nitty grittiness. My mom wanted to escape all of that and she wanted to travel. And so this desire for independence, for a fresh start, for bettering yourself, motivated my mom to also look into nannying over in Canada. And my mom brought up the foreign domestic movement in Canada from 1981 to 1992. And so my mom was a live-in nanny in Calgary, Alberta. She was able to nanny for 2 years and then apply for residency. And she mentioned there's a lot of British nannies, but there are a lot of nannies that came from the Philippines and the Caribbean as well. And she talks about this kind of hierarchy where nannies in general were not treated the best. If we're looking at like a class system of things, think about the middle to upper middle class people who are primarily white who are able to afford nannies. And then the people who were doing the nannying. So my mom said that the people who were nannies from the Philippines, she said the people that they worked for treated them essentially like slaves. Like, and the fact that you were living in their house, you were like on demand, on the clock all the time. And my mom had stories of different nannies who'd be really taken advantage of and their time was not respected. And so there's the class hierarchy there, but there's also the racial distinctions within that hierarchy also. And those ideas of power. So just going back to the interview with my mom thought and still thinks of Canada as a place where it was okay to better yourself. And I talked before about the accents, the Glaswegian accent, and how, you know, if you were trying to break from that, you were looked down upon by local Glaswegians as like trying to be too good for yourself and too snobby. And And my mom really, she kept reiterating this disdain for the Glaswegian accent as a reminder of the horrible upbringing and attitudes and living in poverty. So that was an interesting theme that came up within our interview, just this idea of language and even the hierarchies within a language and implications for that. So, I also talked to my mom and asked her if she ever gets homesick, because I feel like right now being in the States, I constantly miss home, miss Canada, and my family. And she said she does not get homesick at all for Scotland or for my granny, because there's such a dark past that she associates with that area. And so Canada has been a way for her to escape that and to move forward and start her own family and be prosperous in that sense. I just wanted to link that into some quotes from Mary Cowie, and specifically taken out of her book from 2006, Black Ants and Buddhists. And from chapter 2, which is a chapter that focuses on compassion, action, and change, she makes mention of some interesting things. So she was reflecting on her upbringing in suburban Long Island. And this is coming from page 27. She states, quote, "My family struggled. My father's salary as a teacher supported our family of 8 and later 10 as 2 cousins came to live with us. After paying the mortgage and taxes, we didn't have enough for food and fuel, end quote. And Mary Cowie talks about how their family oftentimes went without heat and had hand-me-down clothes as a few of those consequences of not having enough to afford both food and fuel. Mary Cowie also goes on to state, quote, for me, the hardest part was keeping this secret when I went outside the realm of my family, when I went to school, end quote. And then on the next page, pages 29 to 30, Mary Cowie talks about how her past and her upbringing helps to influence her teaching philosophy and how she approaches different topics in the classroom. So she states, quote, I always assumed that there are some families in my class struggling economically. Because of the stigma surrounding it, especially in our materialistic culture, great pains are often taken to mask poverty. And then she goes on to say how she challenges stereotypes by telling stories from her own life. She says on page 30, quote, as a teacher, I find it powerful to draw on and speak from my own experiences. Having grown up in a struggling family, having been a single mother working a minimum wage job, end quote. So when I link that to my mom and her upbringing, I think about, again, her mom, my granny, was a single mom as well, had a lot of part-time jobs, you know, had to struggle raising three kids from three different fathers that were not in the picture. My mom mentioned this tenement or apartment living where there'd be one bathroom shared by everyone on a floor of that apartment, and how three kids, so my mom, her brother, and her sister, plus my granny, lived in a studio apartment. And just my mom also remembers getting free school dinners because she was considered to be poor, and how she found that to be very humiliating and felt inferior. But nobody ever outright talked about this poverty. She doesn't remember her friends like making fun of her or drawing attention to that, but she herself felt so inferior and was aware of her social economic status. So I just relate that to those quotes from Mary Cowie, and how, again, by doing this assignment and getting to delve a little bit deeper into my family and that their past helps to influence, you know, how empathetic I am in the classroom and how aware I am of different backgrounds and different stories that people are coming to the class with. I know when I was younger, I wouldn't say that we were poor in the same sense of my mom, but my mom is still a stay-at-home mom, and my dad was the sole breadwinner, and there was five kids. And so, you know, I remember going to thrift stores and relying on hand-me-down clothes from cousins, and, you know, not being able to buy new things or go on these family vacations. So it's a little bit different from my mom's upbringing, but I think still it influences how I, as a teacher, would like to go forward and not assume that everybody has the same level of economic independence as everybody else. And some people are struggling, and we need to be aware of that. And also, just like Mary Cowie, she talks about this sharing and telling of her own stories to challenge stereotypes. And I would say, you know, create a sense of vulnerability. I hope to do that as well. So my students can see me as a person, as a human being that comes from different backgrounds, as opposed to like a teacher who's all knowing and all powerful. So that was a little bit about my mom and my dad and their motivations to come to Canada. They came separately to Canada, but they both met up in Calgary, Alberta. And I asked my mom a little bit about being in an interracial relationship in the 80s in Calgary. And she doesn't remember receiving like any sort of criticism or negative response. And she didn't think anything of it. Also, when I talked to my dad, he echoed similar sentiments. So I was surprised by that, considering like interracial relationships and marriages back in the 80s were definitely not as prominent or mainstream as I see them being today. I think my mom mentioned the only time she was a little bit worried about my dad or being in an interracial relationship with my dad was when they were like visiting my granny back in Scotland. She was afraid that there'd be some ridicule or harassment there. But she also said, this is going back to accents, that the British in general were so obsessed with American English, American accents, that and they kind of blurred American and Canadian to be interchangeable. So the fact that my dad, you know, had an American or Canadian accent, spoke English in a different way from them, he didn't have any problems, is what my mom said. So that's really interesting, the power of language and dialects. That's something that was kind of coming up in my interviews. But yeah. So in the next segment, I'm going to talk about the theme of individuals, groups, and institutions with a specific focus on religion. So I'll do that shortly after this break. Welcome back. As mentioned, I am moving on to the social study theme of individuals, groups, and institutions with a specific focus of religion in the lives of my mom, my dad, and myself. Speaking of which, again, relating back to the cultural research assignment, for this particular theme, I chose the Book of Mormon as the artifact that I associated with this theme. And I mentioned here that it's one of the religious texts that Mormons, or otherwise known as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, believe in. And the reason why I had chose this artifact to represent my time growing up in this church and wanting to note the impact that this religious institution had on my life. And it was an integral part of my life until my early 20s when I decided not to practice it any longer. But this religion prescribed to us the norms and behaviors that we were supposed to follow. And these are norms that, you know, identify devout Mormons in general. So like not drinking alcohol, not using drugs, dressing modestly, not dating before the age of 16. And this religion also stressed the importance of families, huge emphasis on families, not only in present day and in this life, but the belief of the importance of families in the afterlife. Also stress the importance of compassion and service towards others, and this idea of emergency preparedness. So yeah, the Mormon religion is a religion that has had an impact and still has trickle effects and impacts my life in different ways. I want to turn my attention over to my dad. When I interviewed him, I got to hear a little bit more about his religious experience, slightly less than what my mom, the amount of detail that my mom went into. But when my dad was talking to me about his schooling experience growing up in elementary school, he talks about how he went to a Christian or an Anglican elementary school. But at home, his family was Hindu and practiced Hinduism to a certain degree. I don't think in a super devout way, but identified as being Hindu at home. But then he would go to school, and in that environment, it was a very Christian inspired school. So this idea of this binary and being caught between two worlds. It's also interesting to note that my dad, after he had met my mom, converted, and I use that in quotation marks, to Mormonism. But I think that was just a way for him to, or for my mom to agree to marry him, was by converting to a religion that she held so dearly to her. So that was kind of a point of contention. If I bring the past to the present and focus on how religion was kind of this point of contention growing up, it always felt divided. My mom would be, and still is, a very devout Mormon. But my dad had the title, but would never, very rarely would he go to church with us. But he was also not very devout in the Hinduism faith as well. Like, I remember the occasional Hindu ceremony. So like a puja, like a house blessing that we would go to for one of my cousins or my aunts and uncles. And also if there was like a Hindu wedding, we would attend that. But outside of that, I don't think my dad really subscribed to any religion, it seemed like. So having that kind of like laissez-faire attitude when it came to religion from my dad versus my mom's devoutness to the Mormon religion, that was tough growing up. Because you would go to church and you would see like these nuclear families or these families with a mother and a father and those roles in the Mormon church as they played, and you know, many kids or kids in this family. And so it was hard. It almost kind of felt like, in a way, my mom was going to church as a single mother because my dad was never there at church. So that brought up those feelings, focusing in on religion. When I turned to my mom, it's very interesting. And I learned some new things by talking to her in this effort to gain information for this Critical Family History podcast. So I learned that my mom's mom, so my granny, actually joined the Mormon church when my mom was 6 weeks old back in 1962. And I never knew this. My granny left the church or became inactive, was not going to church when my mom was 5 years old. And then she came back to church when my mom was 14 years old. And at that time, my mom was baptized as a member of the Mormon church. Typically in Mormonism, you'll get baptized when you're 8. But if you're like a new convert, or I mean, it's not a strict rule that you need to, but usually kids that grow up in the church are baptized when they're 8. But because my granny had been out of the church during that time, when she came back, then my mom was baptized when she was 14 years old. And then it's interesting to see this pattern of on and off again with respect to the Mormon church. My mom talks about how she became inactive, or she stopped going to church when she landed in Canada in 1981. And she didn't go to church for 9 years. And during that time, she met my dad. she had me. And I asked her why she thought that was. And she said it was because she wasn't hanging around many Mormons in Canada, even though she had that one friend who was Mormon and was a nanny that came to Canada. That same friend later went back to Scotland after a year of nannying. So she didn't have that strong connection to, I guess, Mormon friends in and around her new area. Yeah, that kind of reminds me, I don't know, I'm seeing like history kind of repeat itself, talking about my granny who was kind of in and out of the church, then my mom's story. And then I think back to my experience where I was pretty devout up until my early 20s. And at that time, I had the opportunity to travel to Korea, Seoul, South Korea, and teach abroad there, teach English for 2 years. And it was around that time where I became inactive and decided that this religion wasn't for me. And so since then, I haven't attended church or done any of the things that would label me an active member of the church, so to speak. So that's just an interesting pattern to notice. The Mormon church's influence, though, with respect to my mom, there is a heavy influence or a heavy emphasis on family history and genealogy, coincidentally. And so my mom has used British census records and the Mormon network and resources like FamilySearch to try and go back generations and generations in the past. And Mormons have the belief that doing this work and finding these names, you're then able to carry out ordinances in the temple to allow them to access the gospel or the Mormon teachings in the afterlife. So that's a little bit of background about that. So going back to this influence of religion and specifically the Mormon church and how, in a way, church brought my mom to Canada. If it wasn't for her Mormon friend who introduced her to this idea of nannying over in Canada, I mean, maybe she would have found out about it in a different way, but it was through this friendship within the Mormon church that she was able to become aware of this opportunity, and that brought her to Canada. I think that is very interesting. But my mom also credits the church with interrupting the cycle of poverty and this hereditary and generational alcoholism that existed, and just kind of switching her focus to family, and yeah, just kind of leaving that sad and angry and kind of dark past behind and trying to interrupt that and rediscover something different for what she envisioned for her family. So as of today, my mom and dad, they have 5 kids together. And 2 of the 5 children are still active in the church. So that's something to look at, past relationships with religion with respect to my mom and my dad, and how that has influenced the children. So that's a little bit about religion and specifically religion as an institution that has had a lot of significance in the lives of my family members. And next, I'm going to start to conclude and close this podcast. And I'm also going to tie everything that I mentioned into this theme of individual development and identity. So join me in a few seconds for that. Thank you. everyone. Welcome back to the last segment of the podcast, where I am going to be tying in this social studies theme of individual development and identity into all that I've been talking about so far and wrapping up this podcast. So going back to this theme of individual development and identity, one more time, I'm going to go back to the cultural me search assignment. And the artifact that I associated with this theme was a picture of my immediate family and how they have impacted my development and my identity. And just like the Canadian flag, I have great pride in being a part of the family that I'm a part of. I'm proud of being able to be the offspring of an interracial marriage, the result of an interracial marriage and growing up biracial, and having that sense of pride in our heritage. But also, when I think about my family, I'm the eldest of five children, so that influences my identity and the different roles that I've taken on. And I also feel like my horizons and my knowledge have been broadened due to the diverse backgrounds that my parents come from. I'm not saying that I know everything, but I'm saying that it gives me kind of two different perspectives, kind of blurring the lines between two different worlds, and getting to tap into knowledge from my mom and my dad that has informed my identity and has contributed to my development in a very significant way. So I wanted to just bring that up. I also wanted to bring up a quote from Ruchi Agarwal Raghunath, and specifically from her book, Social Studies, Literacy and Social Justice in the Common Core Classroom, from 2013. And I want to focus on an excerpt that comes specifically from a chapter called Inspiring Wonder. And this quote comes from page 19. And she says, quote, "There is an implicit message in many classrooms and schools for students to remain quiet, learn what they need to learn, and pass the test. Consequently, students learn not to ask questions in schools and not to question what they learn in school. In a social justice classroom, however, students are encouraged to use their voices and share their opinions so that they are active, contributing members of their classroom community. Teachers can take advantage of students' curiosity and wonder by allowing opportunities for students to explore their important and meaningful questions. We need to awaken and invite the questions children do have to tap into wonder," end quote. And so, Agarwal Raghunath is talking about a very student-centered social justice classroom. And I feel that this past summer quarter, studying at the University of Washington in the elementary teacher education program, it has been very student-centered. And we have been inspired to think critically and ask questions and not just, keep quiet, learn the material, pass the test. That idea is constantly being disrupted. And one great example of that is this assignment, this Critical Family History podcast. I have never done a podcast as an assignment for a class before. And by doing so and interviewing my mom and my dad and looking back at things like the origin of my maiden name and what artifacts I associate with different themes and what has a lot of meaning for me, these are all ways that I have been able to and have been encouraged to use my voice to share my opinions, to share the knowledge that I've gained, and to constantly feed into that curiosity and ask questions. And I'm not going to lie, doing this podcast has by asking questions, more questions have come up from that. As I mentioned, my dad making the comment that he doesn't recall experiencing racism. I feel like that's something that I would want to explore a little bit more. I find it interesting. So just by doing this podcast, I've been empowered to be curious and ask questions and to uncover truths and to learn. So this idea of inspiring wonder and awakening and empowering, those are all ways that I would describe this assignment and also what I want to bring to my teaching philosophy in my classroom. Just reflecting on what I've talked about so far, I've learned a lot about my parents. As I mentioned, I've learned some new things that I didn't know, like my dad disliking his strict teacher, Ms. Ramsaran, who later moved to Canada. I didn't know too many details about my mom's background in terms of, the family history of mental health issues and alcoholism, specifically depression in my granny and alcoholism from what she can remember with her brief exposure to her biological father. I've been able to learn a lot more. What does this mean for me? I think back to Mary Cowie, who I love, and I feel like I can refer back to these family narratives and learn from them and, share different aspects of my life and be honest about my life and share them with my students and my future children. Just like Mary Cowie said that she oftentimes does as a way of challenging stereotypes, as a way to rethink what poverty is, what poverty looks like, different avenues to that. I'm also reminded of Leanne Simpson's idea of intelligence as flowing through relationships. In speaking with my mom and my dad, I've learned so much in such a small amount of time. It's kind of sparked that wonder and curiosity to want to talk to more relatives and get their perspectives, and which I think is important, not just being confined to a single story and kind of broadening your view and hearing different perspectives on maybe a similar event. And lastly, I think that this assignment is such a great idea, and I think I can bring it into my classroom and, adjust it based on the age level that I'm teaching. But I think getting students to analyze a little bit more about their past as much as they can, as much as people are willing to share, is beneficial and a learning experience, and helps to keep narratives alive. So I've really appreciated getting to create this podcast and uncovering different elements within my family history, and also seeing how they relate to social study themes and standards. And I'm very appreciative. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks.